And live from Ben's Next Door, this is the Raucous Caucus with Terry D. Kester as your host tonight. And to my right is...
Mark Levine.
And to my other right...
Barack Obama. Garland Nixon.
Garland Nixon. Okay. This is the
Who Raucous... has a Messiah
combat. I got confused there. I thought I was
Yeah,
Barack
we know
Obama.
You're... That's all right. Stay confused for the rest
I
of the
I often have that
week.
Problem.
This is the Raucous Caucus broadcast on WPFW every single Tuesday live, 7 p.m. right down here at Ben's Next Door, which is next door to Ben's Chili Bowl.
1213 U Street, for those that like addresses, as some
right
do.
It was
still northwest. Yeah, plenty of time. We got an hour. Come on
we
down.
We got an hour. You can come on down now. If you're out in the house there listening, come on up. And later on, we'll take questions from the audience. So if you've got opposing views, we'll take opposing views. No question about it. And we are going to begin here in our topic and have our usual raucous discussion. Although tonight, we're going to probably be a little more thoughtful and a little calmer.
Speak for yourself.
I was about to say.
Well, oh, boy. Oh, that got loud all of a sudden. My goodness, that hurt. Boy, I'll tell you, it's painful here. It's painful here. Anyway, too hot on the Thank you. All right, now we're in control here. We're in control, almost in control. Even though it's a beautiful day and it's warm and wonderful outside and everybody's having a great time, I want to point out to you a quote from Martin Luther King Jr. And that quote is, we have a few technical problems.
That's
here.
The pretty, we got live radio, you get all the excitement and everything.
Okay.
So we're good.
All right, we all right? We in control here? Whoa, boy, we're awful loud on the headsets. Do we have liftoff yet?
Go.
All right, we're trying to broadcast here from Ben's Next Door. We're having a few problems. We're going to have a few more problems once we get into it because Mark and Garland are, anyway.
We're right and you're wrong, basically.
Well, there's always that, yeah. All right, anyway. The opposite of poverty is justice. Martin Luther King, 43 years ago, a couple days ago, as a matter of fact, 43 years ago on the 4th, Martin Luther King was assassinated. It is
42 years ago.
It is not appropriate to not deal with this now and to mention this always. I don't know about you guys. I was in my office at Penn State University directing television. My wife called me just about this time. It was 7:10 Eastern Daylight Time that Martin Luther King had been assassinated.
I think I was playing with a Fisher-Price toy.
I was in diapers.
Around a little truck or something.
Which will make it for an interesting discussion because obviously, from our different, I hate to mention ages, we have a wholly different, sort of reaction to what happened back then. And, of course, only a couple years later, I was in New York City and got the news, of course, that Bobby Kennedy had been assassinated. The 60s and the 70s that I was part of, were in a unique and rather exciting and frightening time. And the question of the day for me is, where are our leaders today? Where are our progressive spiritual leaders today compared to what we had? Maybe it's not possible. We'll find out. We'll get into that. But first, out of tribute, want to hear a little bit of Martin Luther King's speech, his very last speech. You're familiar with it, I'm sure. It is memorable. It is moving. It is Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Let's hear that, please.
Thank you very kindly, my friends. As I listen to Ralph Abernathy and his eloquent and generous introduction, and then thought about myself, I wondered who he was talking about. It's always good to have your closest friend and associate to say something good about you. And Ralph Abernathy is the best friend that I have in the world. I'm delighted to see each of you here tonight. In spite of a storm warning, you reveal that you are determined to go on anyhow. Something is happening in Memphis. Something is happening in our world. And you know, if I was standing at the beginning of time with the possibility of taking a kind of general and panoramic view of the whole of human history up to now, and the Almighty said to me, Martin Luther King, which age would you like to live in? I would take my mental flight by Egypt. And I would watch God's children in their magnificent trek from the dark dungeons of Egypt through, or rather across the Red Sea, through the wilderness on toward the Promised Land. And in spite of its magnificence, I wouldn't stop there. I would move on by Greece and take my mind to Mount Olympus. And I would see Plato.
And
I would see Plato.
And we're back once again. That speech, which we do not have the right section of, unfortunately, but I'm going to refresh your memory a bit to get us on course here. That is a speech given by Dr. Martin Luther King the day before he is executed. Assassinated. It is a speech given, to keep it in perspective, delivered to people in Memphis, essentially the garbage workers, the sanitation workers, on strike at that time, receiving no help from the city of Memphis, living at below living wage. By the way, even with the assassination, just so you know, they got a raise of a dime. A dime per hour was the raise that was given at that time. That is the speech also, and we'll try to find that memorable segment for you, because it is the memorable segment. Of course, I Have a Dream, and I've Been to the Mountain. It is the beautiful, beautiful speech. It is a speech where he is talking about there is no fear, and he is past fear. And to remind you, on the plane trip to Memphis, they actually had to delay his flight because there was a bomb threat on the plane. So they had to delay the flight for that and check to make sure all the baggage was there. When he got to Memphis, there were threats galore to him, death threats galore to him. And it was after even receiving all those threats that he went ahead with this incredible, beautiful speech, the last speech that he ever gave before he was shot that night. Yes, Mark?
I was going to say, of course, the imagery in that speech. I've been to the mountaintop. I've seen the Promised Land. Of course, in the Bible, you have Moses, the leader of his people, where he has seen the Promised Land. He has seen the future. He's seen the land of Israel, but he cannot cross. He cannot go in. He cannot live in what would be the idealistic world, the perfect world that he's led them to. He has to die so that his children can go in. And many, of course, have wondered if Martin Luther King foresaw his own execution, his own assassination, because, of course, the very next day.
The very next day. And right. it's also important to remember that this speech was given 1 year to the day, 1 year to the day of the Riverside Church speech, which is where he spoke out against the Vietnam War, when very few other leaders were. This is also a very short time after he'd started the Poor People's Campaign. And within his organization and outside of his organization, he was being ripped because he was supposedly moving away from civil rights into broader issues of poverty and the Vietnamese War. Whether that is tied into how his assassination occurred, I guess none of us really know. But it was incredible, brave, spiritual, visionary challenge that he was making to the United States of America and to the people of America. And it was bigger than even civil rights, if that's possible to imagine. Garland, I'm sure you're familiar with that speech. I mean, your thoughts?
Well, a couple things. Number one, I just want to mention that I have been to Memphis to the actual motel where he was assassinated. They've turned that into an African-American museum. In fact, the gentleman that owns FedEx contributed a lot of money to that, and it is a place that everyone should go. They actually have the room there as it was, and they have the locations. They actually bought the building across the street where the individual shot from. It's just an extraordinary museum. Museum, and I think everyone should go there because it covers the whole civil rights thing. They actually have the bus that Rosa Parks sat on and all kinds of interesting things there. So just from the perspective of the place, I think it's outstanding what they've done with it. But one other thing I'd like to say, and that is, what's interesting is this. It's as you said many times, Terry, it's impossible to separate economic justice from any other type of social justice, and that when he brought the economic justice together is when, unfortunately, a lot, and he started talking about the Vietnam War. Unfortunately, that's when a lot of the people within the system who accepted his arguments against racism and discrimination actually turned on him when he was suddenly against war and against economic injustice.
Yeah, I'd like to just echo that point. I think that as difficult and as much as this nation fought from the Civil War on, continuing to today, for racial justice, it's fascinating that when Martin Luther King turned to economic justice and turned to wars that we shouldn't be fighting, that's when a lot of his allies left him. Many of them were with him, liberal, white, Lyndon Johnson was with
mainstream
him.
Mainstream politicians.
Was with him with the civil rights movement. I mean, listen, a lot of America wasn't. But many were there and dropped off when he started talking about economic justice, when he started talking about wars that we didn't need to fight. A lot of people said, Martin Luther King, you've gone too far. You're supposed to be about racial justice. You shouldn't even be, even black leaders were saying, you shouldn't be talking about Vietnam. That's not what you're famous for. Be quiet. And he decided, no, he had to talk about it.
And I want to mention, and the reason we're going into this tonight is simply because, in case you haven't noticed, we haven't achieved economic justice. You noticed that? Good. Okay.
Really? There's
okay.
Still poverty?
There's still poverty.
Okay, I guess there is.
Now, in my mind, the poor of today are the lepers. They're almost invisible. We don't even talk about it. We don't even talk about poverty. There aren't government programs that are really doing much of anything. In fact, there's a fascinating book out by Michelle, what is her name?
Bachman?
No.
Oh, I don't think it's just a guess.
Michelle Alexander. She's a professor at Yale Law School. Her book is The New Jim Crow.
That sounds like a book Michelle Bachman would write. She'd be in favor of
that. No, she'd be like the neo.
Hold on, Garland. Hold on. You're not helping here. You're not helping.
Remake Jim Crow. I think it's Michelle Bachman.
Yeah. Her point is Jim Crowism still exists in an extraordinary way. Most of you know that. The simplest way it is, you just imprison every black man you possibly can. You take away all of their civil rights, all of their voting rights, and everything else, and you've got exactly the same situation that you had back in the 1950s and 60s and before them. Economically, there has been, for the majority, and she makes the point that there's obviously individual success amongst African Americans. Here's one of them right here, Garland Nixon. There he is. Of course, President Obama.
Are you black, Garland?
Well, almost.
I just
thought
you had a good tan. I had no idea. Okay,
I didn't call myself Barack Obama for nothing, buddy.
I had no idea. All right, sorry. Excuse me.
Just surprise.
Revelation.
Surprise.
Go ahead.
Okay. But she makes the point, which is a profound point, that the individual success of people like Mark, I'm Garland.
You're having a rough time. He pointed at Mark.
I mean, for those of you on the radio, he pointed at Garland.
Yeah,
and
right.
But
people often mistake us for each other.
That's why you have to come to Ben's to see that we maybe don't look quite as much alike as Terry thinks so, but he's getting up in age. So we have eye problems.
All co-hosts look alike, right? I mean, let's be honest about this, okay? The other point that I wanted to make is the economic inequality that is far worse today than it was when Martin Luther King was demonstrating and trying to organize the Poor People's March. Now, yes, there's a level of poverty that we say is nice and comfortable because they all got, a contaminated trailer or something like that to live in. But the fact
is, the same trailer?
The fact is that during Martin Luther King's time,
that's crowded.
The income gap between CEOs and the average worker was 45 to 50 times. CEOs making 45 to 50 times more than the average worker in the 50s and 60s. Today, it is 350 times the average worker, and it's 1,000 times minimum wage. To give you one graphic example, right here in Washington, D.C., the median age here in Washington, median wage income, rather, I'm sorry, in Washington, D.C., is $100,000 for whites. For what?
Is it really that high? I'm surprised it's that high.
Yeah, a little bit of a power groupie town. And the median wage for, or rather income for African Americans, $39,000.
Wow.
About a third. Since 43 years ago, when Martin Luther King was assassinated, not much has really been done. It really hasn't. And as she points out, individual success often masks what's happening to the majority of the minorities, be they black, be they Latino, in this country. So my question is tonight, and the reason I brought all this up is because not only can I still remember the pain when Dr. King was shot, when I see shows of it, or when Bobby Kennedy, when I see shows, I still weep. I mean, you know, it was not a good time to be around. And I can remember the demonstrations there and everything else. But my point is, where the hell are the leaders today? Where the hell are the visionary leaders today? Where are the leaders that have a spiritual foundation? If we had played that clip that we wanted, and if we get it later, we will play it. You'll remember, I'm sure, that one thing Martin Luther King did, besides his personal integrity, besides his activism, is he never hid the fact that he was a preacher. And he was proud of being a preacher. And he brought the spiritual, for him, the Christian viewpoint, into his speech and to his work every single time. Today we have politicians mouthing like crazy. We have talk show hosts mouthing like crazy. Not here, of course. Here it's all intelligence. But, you know, but I am really seriously concerned we don't have leaders, and I'm wondering even if this country is capable of supporting a leader or unifying behind a leader. Not that they were all unified behind Martin Luther King, obviously not, but there was great progress made because of that man, because of his vision, because of his courage. Where are they today, Mark?
Where are they today? Well, you know, we have different times, I guess, from then.
Not according to the figures.
No, not talking about different economic times. Oh, okay. I'm talking about different political times.
Yeah, okay.
I think the entire right wing that we see today, the Fox propaganda channel didn't exist in 1968. They had other propaganda channels, but not the kind of incessant, really, lies to the American people that's told by an organization developed to preserve corporations, to preserve the status quo. Now, there were such organizations, to be sure. But at this point, we have people who are lower middle class who are actually advocating against the very programs that would help them achieve the American dream. It's an amazing thing. It's not certainly unheard of in American history. I mean, let's not forget the Confederate white soldiers, three-quarters of whom didn't own slaves, fighting for the plantation owners that did own slaves for their right to own slavery. It's really very strange, fighting to keep people in bondage, and they didn't profit from it. They've always had rich people, that are enjoying the status quo, trying to divide people who are hurting into races, into genders, into all kinds of things.
I would make the point from what you're saying.
But I think that today it's even more pervasive. The other thing I think is that racial justice is ironically easier, and I've never said it's easy in my life before now, but it's easier than economic justice.
Because I agree.
It's very easy to see an extremely rich, talented person who happens to be African-American, who's not allowed to drink from a water fountain, or who's hosed down by Bull Connor. That kind of thing really sears the imagination. But most poor people, dare I say, are trying to survive. They're trying to feed their children. They're trying to pay their rent. Some of them are just trying to get homes. And it's very hard to do a revolution when you're just trying to eat. And one of the interesting things about the 60s, and I would say about virtually every revolution in world history, is it's not usually led by the poorest of the poor. Martin Luther King was not a poor man. He did not come from a dirt poor family. All right? And the same is true for whether it's the French Revolution, the American Revolution. You need to have the middle class working in solidarity with the poor to really, I think, move forward. And we've had that separation now, at least since the Reagan era.
Yeah.
Well, and the other point, I'm picking up on your point, I want to get you garnering into it, too. I mean, to me, what seems is since then what's happened is the industrial financial powers, maybe we don't have slavery, maybe we don't legally have Jim Crow, but they are more powerful, obviously, today. They are much more powerful than they were then. They have much more power over the economy. They have much more power over social trends, whether it's right-wing radio or whatever it is. They've had much more power than they actually had back in the 60s and 50s. And I'm still asking the question, who is going to stand up to them? Where is that leader who is going to stand up? Certainly there was no unity behind Martin Luther King when he started. I mean, for heaven's sakes, you know, hardly. He was jailed constantly, of course. He was harassed. He was threatened. He was threatened by the government. He was threatened by individuals. But still, he stood up. Where is that? And would we, the other question is, would we as Americans, would we even accept such a leader today? That's one of the real questions. Would we even accept it? Garland.
Yeah, that's a good question. And one of the things is this, that real progressive leaders, they get attacked immediately by the media. An example was a good prime example. One of the people to look at is Howard Dean, and that scared a lot of people. Howard Dean basically came out when he was running for president, and he said to progressives, "It's okay to be kind of confrontational.
Passionate,
it's okay to be passionate. It's okay to be tough. You don't have to kind of sit on your hands and say we don't like the way things are. You can come out and you can be tough. You don't have to be angry, but you can be passionate." And
it's okay to be a little angry.
Right. And
you're not burning things
down. And he woke a lot of people up who were very unhappy with the way things were going under the Bush administration. And people, it kind of started a roll. But what happened? He was basically, if you know the story of it, he was pretty much taken out by the media over the alleged. Yeah, there was a whole lot. I don't want to really get into that. But the messages get sent to people who are strong progressive leaders that we're going to come after you. They go after Dennis Kucinich. You know, oh, well, you saw a UFO or things like that. Dennis Kucinich is always made to look like some kind of a kook. But time and again, he's right when it comes to the Iraq War, when it comes to the Bush tax cuts. Time and again, he's been right. I haven't agreed with everything he's done, but more often than not, he's been right. But they make him seem like some kind of a weird fringe guy. So I'll just finish this up. One of the issues of progressive leaders today is, with the media that we have, if you come out as a strong progressive media, they're going to go after you like a piranha, and they're going to push you and try to make you look like some kind of a fringe person. So I think it's difficult to be a progressive leader with the media environment that we have today.
I would disagree with you, and I disagree for one specific reason, because a progressive leader is not what Martin Luther King was, and a progressive leader is not enough. There are certainly progressive politicians, to be sure. There's progressive people that I respect, from John Conyers, who was here a couple of weeks ago, you know, et cetera. But that is not the same as a Dr. Martin Luther King. These men, as wise as they may be, as progressive as they be, are not willing to risk their lives. They're not willing to march in front of up to Bull Connor. They're not ready to go into the midst of the trouble and confront the establishment and stand there in a pacifist way, a nonviolent way. They're not willing to express their spiritual point of views. They're not progressive. There are progressive leaders, but that isn't enough. That isn't enough to inspire people. And obviously, the fact of the matter is, if you look around, since nobody's particularly inspired, that sort of proves the point.
Well,
you need a leader who is more than just a political further left than somebody else.
I like to throw out the question, does the man make the times or the times make the man?
Both.
It seems to me that the times were ripe for Martin Luther King, for Rosa Parks, that when you have people who are discriminated against, not based on wealth, interestingly enough, but based on some arbitrary characteristic, and I think it's true for the women's movement, I think it's true for gay rights movement, I think it's true for religious discrimination, for things that really anyone who's fair sees as completely arbitrary, then people say, well, you know, that's wrong. It's usually easier to get through their brains. When you come to economic discrimination, in a capitalist country, in the idea among many Americans, let's face it, and it's an idea, by the way, I think that permeates not just the rich, but many of the poor as well as the middle class, that if you're rich, well, maybe you worked hard and deserved it, and if you're poor, maybe you didn't deserve it. There is this philosophy here. It's always been there. Ronald Reagan magnified it. And then, of course, people don't think it through. They don't think through the fact that, well, but the Republicans don't want inheritance taxes, so they want lazy people to, you know, earn millions of dollars without working, and that the working poor, they don't want to give them child care. They don't think the details through. But the general concept, and I have to say, it's sad to say it's growing. There are even some churches today that are explicitly rejecting Jesus' message. Prosperity Gospel, they call
it.
Yes,
the Prosperity
Gospel.
Where
they say,
gospel.
if you're rich, God likes you, and if you're poor, God doesn't like you. Exactly the opposite, a complete perversion of what Jesus had to say. And yet there are people, largely in the Republican Party, largely the Tea Party movement, that say, well, yeah, if you're poor, you deserve it.
One of the questions that brings up, and this is the real question to me too, is, you know, it's a chicken or egg situation, which came first, Martin Luther King or the movement. If you study the history of Martin Luther King, I mean, they were actually working on the movement for a long,
long time. Long before.
Legally and everything else.
Right. No.
You know,
Thurgood Marshall.
Yeah, it didn't just pop out of nowhere.
No, I know that.
But Martin Luther King, at least in the very beginning, plus other people, Stokely Carmichael, et cetera, were willing to stand up right then and there, whatever that moment was, and confront the leaders of the country.
And what I'm saying, just to understand my point, what I'm saying is in 1963, the time was ripe for a Martin Luther King. If Martin Luther King had come on the stage in 1933, I don't think he'd have achieved the greatness he did. And if he came on the scene in 2010, I'm not so sure he would have had the same impact as he did in 1963.
Yeah,
that's my only point about the time. It's no slant on the man. It's to recognize that sometimes the times create a hero where it wouldn't the same man at a different time.
Right. What more do we need, though, to create that hero is my question. I mean, you know, the unemployment rate is incredible, particularly amongst African Americans. You know, it's far greater than amongst whites. It is not improving. If you read someone like Stephen Pearlstein, who I think is one of the better economic analysts in the country, this recession is not going away. The debt is extraordinary. Of course, it's not going to hurt the big banks. It's not going to hurt the big companies. But the economic situation is getting worse and worse for the middle class, and certainly worse for the poor. Garland?
Well,
and I mean, where is the leader that's going to stand up spiritually, emotionally, who's going to lead somebody, you know, put himself out there on the line, whether he gets shot or not? Where is that courage?
I think one of the issues Mark's bringing up to is with the times is this, and it's something that I've run into it. Some of the things I've worked, the issues I've worked on healthcare, and that is the fragmentation of those out there who would be supporting the progressive leader. When I worked on healthcare, there were people who I worked on Capitol Hill with people who started the single payer movement, started the healthcare movement, and when they towards the end said, "Well, I'm going to moderate on this issue or this," okay, I'll go along with this. People turned on them who were in the so-called single payer movement with people who started it and said, "You're a liar and you're a thief because you don't agree with me on a particular small little individual issue." One of the issues that I have is that there is so much fragmentation. As you know, Joel came and we talked about one of our particular supporters came and we talked about that one day, and that is that there are a lot of progressive organizations that are fighting amongst each other. They can't come up with a single platform that we're all in favor of, you know, the environment, climate change, and some social justice issues that say we're all for this. Yes, we're for gay rights, or yes, we're for the environment, or this or that, but we're all for a central platform that we can work together. One of the problems is these so many progressive organizations now, there are so many of them, there weren't that many before, they're like a herd of cats, they're going in every different direction, they're fighting against each other, and as soon as one progressive organization has the slightest disagreement with another one, they're the enemy.
And they're also fighting for all the same slice of the pie, which is part of the problem as well. We're running out of time here. We got to take our break in just a moment. And we'll be back on this. We do have the clip set up, so right after the break, we will be hearing the clip. This is the Raucous Caucus. It's not quite as raucous
tonight. Right here at Ben's.
We're being thoughtful tonight, and hopefully we're being helpful as well as thoughtful. This is the Raucous Caucus at Ben's Chili Bowl. No, Ben's next door.
1213 U Street. There's still time to join us if you're driving around. We've got a couple seats left. You can bring, have a nice drink.
We
got to
go away.
Dotted throughout the interior of the United States are Native American communities, well hidden from the sight of the majority of Americans and the world. Within these communities exists less than third world poverty. Most Native Americans that live within the confines of the state of South Dakota this winter find themselves without heat, water, or electricity. The weather has not been kind in the Dakotas this year.
A state of emergency has been declared on the Pine Ridge Reservation due to a lack of money to buy propane for heat and electricity. The water on Pine Ridge is contaminated. On the Cheyenne River Reservation, there are between 13,000 to 17,000 American Indians without heat and electricity because 6,000 electrical poles have snapped due to blizzards, snow, and extremely high winds. It drops to 50 below zero wind chill factor nightly.
There is little or no food or drinking water on these reservations. We can't wait for the U.S. government to decide to march in and save the Indians. It is almost too late now. Please help me and my sisters and friends here at WPFW save Native American children, elders, and families right now. Please take a moment and write a tax-deductible donation in a check made payable to Seeds of Faith Ministries Incorporated, a registered nonprofit with a notation in the bottom of your check, Night Wolf American Indian Relief Effort, and mail it to Seeds of Faith Ministries, Incorporated, Post Office Box 498, Millersville, Maryland, 21108. Or give Steve Hansberger a call, 471-1934, for more information.
And brought into being the Civil Rights Bill, if I had sneezed, I wouldn't have had a chance later that year in August to try to tell America about a dream that I had had, if I had sneezed. I wouldn't have been down in Selma, Alabama, to see the great movement there if I had sneezed. I wouldn't have been in Memphis to see a community rally around those brothers and sisters who are suffering. I'm so happy that I didn't sneeze. And they were telling me. Now it doesn't matter now. It really doesn't matter what happens now. I left Atlanta this morning, and as we got started on the plane, there were six of us. The pilot said over the public address system, "We are sorry for the delay, but we have Dr. Martin Luther King on the plane, and to be sure that all of the bags were checked, and to be sure that nothing would be wrong on the plane, we had to check out everything carefully. And we've had the plane protected and guarded all night." And then I got into Memphis, and some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out, or what would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Heard that speech, you know, saw the news clips of it, saw the power and the beauty of that man, and then a few hours later, dead. You know, you sometimes accuse me of being a bit of a pessimist, and I reject that. But I lived when John Kennedy was president and made some promises and watched him get killed. I lived when Martin Luther King got killed, and I was working in the movements of both. I lived when Bobby Kennedy, I was working for Eugene McCarthy, and Bobby Kennedy got killed. And if that doesn't lead one to a little bit of cynicism and despair, then one just ain't paying attention. You know, and what bothers me the most, and the reason I've chosen this topic again tonight to talk about today, is because these problems have not been faced, they have not been solved, they have not been dealt with. We've got laws galore that take care of various issues and help out this person and that person and help some people collectively, and I'm not, you know, dismissing that, but in general we still have a racist society in many, many ways, and we know that. We may have a black president, but we still have racism rampant. We do have a class war going on. Nobody wants to call it that, except Rush Limbaugh, who then denigrates it as soon as he brings it up. But the reason he brings it up, because he's perfectly aware there is a class war.
He's fomenting it.
And it's a class war that's way beyond what it was when Martin Luther King was making the struggle. Economically, at least, maybe they have food stamps, maybe they have enough food, maybe they don't, although 40% of poor children go hungry at least 3 days a week. Maybe they have enough food in general, but the point is, in terms of access, political power, dignity, we are further behind than we've ever been before. And if we do care about Martin Luther King, and if we do care about his vision and his dream, then frankly, we've got to ask the question, am I willing to go out on the street and risk death? That's what it really comes down to.
Well,
you know, am I willing to go out there and make that stand alongside or individually, but preferably alongside someone, because I don't think I'm that leader, but, you know, alongside some leader, if there were one, am I willing to go out there and let the dogs be at my feet trying to get me and the fire hose and the police now with nice little plastic bracelets, which we've all had the pleasure of wearing? You know, are you guys willing to go out there and sacrifice your life and put your life on the line? That's the real question.
Well, that brings up a question that has to be asked, and that is, to effect change, what's more effective, working outside of the system, lying in the street, getting arrested, et cetera, working within the system, trying to make change within the system, or I would argue in all likelihood some combination of both, because there is certainly a place for taking to the streets, therefore doing things of that nature, whatever civil unrest, whatever a person may deem necessary that way. But I think you can't also, let's not forget, for all of that, Martin Luther King got the Civil Rights Bill passed, and there was a lot of compromise there because there were a lot of people who were unhappy because it was very watered down. They didn't get the Voting Rights Act, but they came back a year later and got that. So if we look at Martin Luther King, yes, he worked outside of the system. Yes, he did. You know, he got arrested.
And inside.
But yes, he worked inside the system. There was a place for both. And I think one of the things that made him a great leader was that he was a master of operating outside of the system. It's difficult to operate outside and inside of the system. Most people can only assume one presence or the other. And I think when you see people who can assume a presence outside of the system, have people march, have people in the street get arrested, but can work in the halls of Congress and on Capitol Hill and with the president to get something passed, I think that's what made him part of a big master.
I think that's a good point, but let me ask you a question, okay. Garland. I also want to mention that the microphone is available for you guys, and if you guys want to jump in here and give us your points of view, we want to hear it. And we
or
want
ask
to discuss
us a question or challenge
ask us a question or challenge us. But still the question is to me is sacrifice. Now, maybe I over-dramatize it in terms of, you know, standing up and getting shot. But, you know, is Kucinich willing to sacrifice? You know, is any of the politicians we have now, are any of the progressive...
I don't think people are out to kill Kucinich.
Are any of the progressive leaders we have out there willing to sacrifice their career, their standing, their popularity, maybe their safety? I don't see that.
Well,
even somebody as wonderful as, and I respect him and love him, John Conyers sitting right here, I don't see a man as willing to sacrifice.
Well, the question is this. In all circumstances, is there a need? Can you operate and be effective without running out in the street and putting a bullseye between your eyes? What I'm saying is this. I think right now, and there's something that we should all be concerned of. Right here in Washington, D.C., and in Virginia, on April 19th, originally they were going to call it the Million Gun March,
right.
But they thought that maybe wasn't a good name, and they've decided
well,
to...
Well, they thought it was a great name.
On the right. anniversary right. of Timothy McVeigh's
right.
bombing
April
19th, of the federal building right. in Oklahoma City.
The anniversary of Waco, which is what the militias and the far-right wing kooks love to get angry about. So on the anniversary of Waco, on the anniversary of Timothy McVeigh killing 168 innocent people, They're going to have a Second Amendment march right here in D.C. We've got people walking around saying reload and all of these gun references. I think what you're saying is salient, Terry, in that there are a lot of people right now who, in all likelihood, there is some level of danger based on the rhetoric that's going on and these terrible things that are happening. I think what you're saying is real because there's a level.
And it requires, you know, it does require that someone stand up
even,
to it.
Who knows? Maybe for even liberal talk show hosts who are standing around here saying this stuff.
I worked on WPFW the first year I was there, and I was told, watch my back by the management.
You know, Sarah Palin.
Do we have a question, sir?
Hold on. I haven't had a chance to respond to what you said before, though. Okay, we can
go
to the question.
We've got questions first.
I got a response.
Audience first.
Then I got to talk. Okay. You said 10 minutes ago. Because I disagree.
Thank you for taking my question. Actually, I have a question.
And introduce yourself. Your name?
My name is Anthony.
Hey, Anthony.
Feel free
Welcome
to
back.
Adjust the mic. Just twist it up. There you go.
There you go.
I have a question and a comment. A comment first. It kind of bothers me when we basically perpetuate caricatures of great leaders. You know, we talk about Martin Luther King. We talk about the Dreamer. You know, we show all of these images and we replay the speeches that are basically comfortable for America to, you know, to digest, but you know, we don't really talk as much about him being ultra progressive, relatively radical. You know, that from my view, at least, particularly towards the tail end of his life, you know, that's the Martin King that we really should be talking about. That's the Martin King.
Thank you.
That was really beneficial for Americana. Secondly, the era of the strong man is over, and I personally say good riddance. You know, look at what we have left. You know, we have the Castros, we have, you know, we have the Chavez. You know, we have a couple of strong men left, but they're too easy to knock down. They're too easy, particularly in our media culture, to just kind of, you know, throw a sex scandal out there and just totally kill their party, totally kill their whole, you know, motivation. You know, it will take absolutely no, you don't even have to shoot them anymore. You know, you can have a very basic scandal, and then
Good
it's
point.
Basically all over. Leadership has to sprout from the quote grassroots. Political leadership can't even do it either, because, you know, they became successful by being co-opted by the system. You know, once you obtain a position, it's basically all over for you as well. So grassroots, people with no real vested interest other than their love for their country, their love for their communities, you know, that's really the only way this is going to happen.
And do you see anybody, Mark, you're next. But do you see anybody now that's standing up that is like that?
It's a good question. Nobody I can think of on a national scale. It's interesting you brought up Van Jones. Thank you very much.
And what happened to him?
Well, first of all, Van Jones also was co-opted.
That's why it's good to have a live audience. So you get a little help from the crowd.
A lifeline here.
But to talk about the environmental movement, you know, the sort of change necessary in the environmental movement that Van Jones represented when he was outside of the administration was serious, radical change. The day after he became part of the administration, it was all over.
Yeah.
You know, we need the old Van Jones back. And basically went and took another government
job.
That's
one of the problems we get. We hate government, we're angry at government, but we also want government to solve everything instead of doing it ourselves. Mark,
what's your name, sir?
My name's Anthony.
Anthony. Anthony, I think you make a really good point about the strong man, as you put it. If we put all our hopes and dreams in one person, whether it be a Martin Luther King, whether it be a Barack Obama, whether it be anybody, then it's too easy to destroy the one person. Everybody has flaws. Even Martin Luther King had flaws. All right, the FBI spied on him and he cheated on his wife. That doesn't it reduce him in any way in my mind, but every human being is human and has flaws. As you point out, you don't have to kill them anymore. You just find a sex scandal, right? You go and you look at Elliot Spitzer's records, you take him down, and now Wall Street can do what he wants. We have lots of people who could be taken down if we look to one person. I think you're absolutely right. We have to look to many people. And as much as I think Barack Obama is doing, I think he's doing a pretty good job. We can argue about whether he's doing as far as he could.
We wouldn't dare.
We do, and that's what makes us raucous. I do think it. I like the idea of not putting all our hopes and dreams in one person.
So do I.
I absolutely agree with you.
Brilliant.
Not that we don't need more visionary leaders, but we need more than one. Two, three, four, five.
Well, give me six. Give me seven.
I'll give you one.
Give me one.
I'll give you somebody who
Did you have a question too?
Is a real.
Yeah.
We got another comment.
Okay.
All right.
No. I find it interesting that people always go to the I Have a Dream speech of Dr. King, but his actual final speech was sleeping through a revolution. And what he did was he compared even the people who followed him to be that of like Rip Winkle, Rip Van Winkle. And basically, you thinking that it's all about me. But you guys will understand, because of these threats, because of the stress, because of the maybe the iniquities that he may have been hiding from based on his perception, he was losing. He was getting to the breaking point of having an alternative action plan of kind of getting things done. And a lot of people don't want to acknowledge that, because what it does boil back down to, it puts the responsibility on you. Even with Barack Obama, what tickles me about Barack Obama is that I don't put my faith in no human, no man, no individual, because we're clearly all flaws. We have flaws, you know.
Nor did Martin Luther King. He didn't claim that either.
No, but we as a society
tend to, yes.
We took this individual and we idealized him. We took perceptions and perspectives of him versus the reality that he was once an individual like us.
And interestingly, we didn't idolize him really until after he was shot.
Yeah.
Because, up at that particular time, his popularity was decreasing like crazy.
And now they want like a 20-foot statue of him? Why do they have to make him larger than life?
Yeah, that offends me. It really does.
You guys and even the listeners, I noticed since people like to pull up Dr. King speeches, I recommend you guys, everyone in here, to listen to his final speech.
Right.
Which was Sleeping Through a Revolution, where he gave us basically the instructions of what was going to happen when he was he knew he was going to go. But the beauty of it was that because he knew that, their agenda to eliminate him so the individuals within us would never have the confidence or faith. You said it right there. That's why there's no leaders, first and foremost.
Still because 43 years later?
Yeah.
42.
Because most people believe the hype that, oh, man, I'm going to die. I'm not going to speak about nothing because I'll lose my job. But Dr. King's thing was, I'll lose my job, but I got 75 people that will let me sleep on their couch or, you know, things of that nature. So the key is to develop a greater dependency on each other versus the system that clearly, obviously, it didn't help your generation for the better. It ain't helping the generation after you. It ain't helping the hip-hop generation. And unfortunately, because we continue to settle for them or these false idols, these dead presidents on money, which ain't even worth nothing, but we still play into that hype.
I hope.
But my thing is, I think you guys, you have a platform. So you are the Martin Luther King. You are Martin Luther King. You are Martin Luther King. Because if you really want the actual leader that you're crying for, it's going to take a sacrifice of all of us. Because one of those leaders who has all of those qualities, and I'm a Christian, it's a guy by the name of Louis Farrakhan. And that's going to sound crazy.
No.
Because he has never worked for any organization. Sharpton, Jackson, all of those guys in some way, whether it's Viacom, whether it's Coca-Cola, whoever it is, they're all on the same team.
Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you very much. And I want to tell you, I want to do one thing. I hope. What is your name? What is your name?
Yeah. My name is W. Ellington Felton.
Okay. I hope you are part of a movement. No, I really do.
Let me ask you this, W. The one thing that's important to me. If our leaders are spreading hate and lies about other peoples, they shouldn't be our leaders.
But you're not hearing me. I'm basing on what he called for. A person who never compromises their beliefs.
Right.
The beliefs of their movement, never denies their identity as a man of God.
But listen to this.
Whether it's your God
or not. If you have a leader that says, among all the constituent groups, he doesn't like Jews, he doesn't like gays, he doesn't like the white girls,
then
we're not going to come together as a movement.
That's not what he's saying at all.
That's not what you're saying.
No.
I'm just saying.
What's unfortunate? What's unfortunate because we settle for the perception of people.
No, I've heard his speeches.
You ain't heard all of it. You've never.
I haven't heard all his speeches.
You've only heard the ones that.
Okay.
But let me throw this in. Because one thing is, I don't think we want to get our. Yeah, I don't think we want to get our discussion focused on any particular individual leader, because I think the discussion is right. Well, let me say this.
Well,
okay, hold it. Let's get some order here.
I don't forgive James O'Reilly either.
So what we're saying is this. This is not about an individual leader.
That's good.
Right.
Okay.
This is about... Right.
Don't go away. Yeah.
Come on back. We can disagree. We can disagree.
But I think one of the things that I'm saying here is this, and I think that's a point that was brought up by Anthony and a point that was discussed here, and it's something I'd like to speak on. And Anthony, and the issue was Van Jones. Once he got a job, he was co-opted. Barack Obama. Let me say first this about Barack Obama. I said this before he was elected. I do not, in any way, shape, or form. I said this before he was elected, think that every single thing Barack Obama does that I will agree with. I don't think that he won't do things that I don't strongly disagree with. If you came in to this thing, I voted with him, for him, for the same reason that I vote for people. If I look at two candidates and I say one of them is closer to my views, then that's the one I'm going to vote to. I'm not going to vote for Cynthia McKinney because she has no chance of getting in. I'm going to vote for the closest one to my views, and I'm going to be realistic and say, how can I affect it? I looked. He was the closest to my views. When I look at Van Jones, I think he's a great guy. I love everything that he's done. I don't think he was co-opted. Here's what I think. And I'll say this. You're talking about a person who worked within the system and outside of the system and had people get mad at me when I was in the system, when I was doing things to help them. And I recognize something. In the system, I can't do things the way you want me to do it and get it done. If you think that I can walk into the system and be the radical Garland, I was with the ACLU. I was on a vice president of the board of directors for the ACLU. I was radical. But I couldn't walk into the system and be radical and get anything done because I was just some radical nutcase in the system and then I was pushed out on the fringe. So I don't agree with the idea that when a person such as Van Jones or Barack Obama gets in the system that they are suddenly co-opted or they're a bad person. I say, here's a person who says, I'm willing to work within the system, and I recognize I got to do things differently.
Okay. Very good. Appreciate that. I think he made the point, though, that once you get into the system, I mean, you automatically are co-opted. There's no way around that.
The question is whether if you achieve part of a goal.
Just one thing, then your turn. You know,
what is co-opted?
One of the mistakes we make is we try to put this faith of leadership or this need of leadership into politicians, and that cannot work. In fact, prior to the election, we practically put him on a pedestal, almost asking for a king to come in. Yes, we can. And let's, you know.
But then that means we don't have to do anything.
Yes, I know. It's very, very easy to sit and complain and say the system never works.
But the politicians
never achieve anything. I disagree.
That's not what we're saying.
Okay, Let me tell you something. Hold on.
Mark. No, we're not saying that. It's where you put your faith for change.
You said that we haven't achieved.
We've only got 6 minutes.
Anything.
Holy cow.
Since 1963. Since 1968.
I didn't say that.
Well, when you say that, you know,
I have given you facts
we still
on
have
economic
poverty.
Situations.
You're absolutely right.
Yes.
But at all times in human history, all right, it's two steps forward, one step back. Maybe it's two steps back, one step forward. We have moved forward. We have more freedoms than we had. African Americans can vote now. They couldn't vote in 1963. They haven't voted enough. And yes, people are trying to keep them from voting. And yes, you know, Ken Blackwell in Ohio made sure that they couldn't vote as much as possible. Yes, there are still challenges to overcome. But if we don't recognize that we have moved forward, that Lincoln did free the slaves, that Medicare and Medicaid do work, food stamps do feed people.
That there are a lot more
African-Americans
in the middle
class. My point
is that
we have a long way to go. But we also have to recognize we have come a long way. Otherwise, if we don't look at the progress in the past, then we lose hope for making progress in the future.
But the hope comes in two ways. The hope comes not only from the past. The hope comes, as the gentleman pointed out, you know, either you begin to believe in yourself and believe in your ideals, and yes, there are people on both sides of the issue, to be sure. But unless you are willing to stand up and not compromise and stand up for those beliefs and state the truth and speak truth to power, no matter what it costs you, you know, you're never going to get a movement that's going to achieve
something. Can you compromise and keep fighting? Can you say, I like Barack Obama, the Democrats' health care bill, but I'm not done? I still want
you're asking the wrong question.
Can you say the Civil Rights Act was great, but it didn't free everybody yet?
Let me answer the question.
Yeah.
I'm saying you couldn't even have a Civil Rights Act or a civil rights discussion if you didn't have a Martin Luther
King. Absolutely, I agree.
That's
I'm not
the
denying
point.
That.
But
that's
I would also add this,
yes,
Terry.
And this gentleman has a question here. We're running short of time. Let's get his question. Yes.
It's not so much a question. Hi, my name is Adam.
Hi, Adam.
Hi, Adam.
I know we're running short on time, so I just want to throw a comment out there.
Please
hopefully
do.
Hopefully simplifies things instead of complicating things. We'll see if it works. Rather than looking for a leader and putting our confidence in people, politicians, whoever, maybe we need to put our confidence in ideas and have some solid ideas to base things on, have an end destination, work towards those things. I think that would solve a lot of the infighting in the progressive movement. I think that
and
would
get what is the idea? What is the idea that you would put forward?
Well, that's going to take a lot longer than we have.
But
very basically, very simply, if you have a foundation that's based on reason, that's fairly objective. I know real objectivity is impossible, but if you have something that's based on solid foundation of reason and logic that everyone can understand and grasp, not on such a subjective level. Which I think basically.
Can you give us an example?
Well, I think any aspect of human rights builds on a foundation of reason, because as a society, we need to treat people fairly, because otherwise, in the most cynical sense, otherwise you're just bringing about trouble for yourself.
So okay. All right. Let's get to there's one more comment out here.
Adam, I would argue that usually we all agree on the ends, but we disagree on whether we're willing to take half measures to get there.
No.
I think within the progressive movement, maybe we do, but the right wingers don't.
Oh, that's true.
And I'm with him.
We've got one more question.
I'm with him 100%.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you very much.
Not necessarily a question. I do agree that we as a country made progress, you know, during the years, but like freeing the slaves, there shouldn't have been slaves in the first place.
Well, you're right.
Yeah.
That's one. And a couple more things. Zeitgeist.com, I want people to check that out. The Obama Deception, I want people to check that out as well. Also, look into the Bilderberg Group. There's a lot of things that,
people need to know about conspiracy theories.
Instead of necessarily looking for a leader, we need to become leaders within ourselves and get pissed off.
On that, I absolutely agree.
All right. There we are. We've only got 3 minutes here. I want to make sure we get the credits in before we get the last few comments here. And first, we got a strength. Flat, blah, 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 blah. Thank Drew, right over here. Drew Frank. And in the studio, working hard, T. Sturdivant. And yes, T., you found the right clip,
and I am grateful.
Way to go. Right there, that beautiful lady, Gladys L. Brooks.
The hardest working woman
producer.
In radio, yeah. Right there.
Right. She's got to deal with us.
Okay. And we've got to, of course, thank Nizam and Tariq at Ben's Next Door. They are our host here. They are the ones that support us here. And, of course, you guys got to all come to Ben's Next Door in the future.
Every Tuesday at 7,
Every
we are
Tuesday.
Here
and,
being
of course,
provocative.
And WPFW 89.3 FM. Of course, we got to thank them for all of their support continually as well. All right. And how much time we got left now, Gladys? I want to make sure we got about two minutes. Okay.
Okay. Then my last statement.
Your last statement.
And I'll go along with what this last gentleman was saying, and that's this. What I talked about and what we've talked about in the past is putting together some type of a progressive organization where there is a foundation of we are for, you know, whether it's human rights, climate change, et cetera, 4 or 5 things that everyone can agree on, so that all of the progressive organizations can all coalesce and say we have our disagreements with these 5 things we agree on and work together, pool our money together, pool our resources together to try to make change, whether it's on the street or whether it's lobbyists or whatever we have to do.
That is so essential. That is so essential.
Find common ground for all the progressive organizations so we don't have to beg a leader.
And
we can work together and get something done.
But we as people have to demand that. I worked at UDC with a conference there on poverty 2 years ago. There were 180 groups. They met for 3 days and couldn't agree on one thing.
How do they get in touch with us?
Okay. What is our website these days? We have a blog site.
I think it's rcndc.com. It's getting better. We're also all on Facebook. You can find all three of us.
My name is Garland Nixon. And you can email me at garlandn@gmail.com, and I'll give you the rest of the info.
I'm Mark Levine. You can find everything out on my website. Go to marklevineradio.com or just Facebook me and watch me fight the right wing.
And I'm Terry D. Kester, and I'm still calling for a movement. I'm still saying let's take it to the streets. You can reach me at WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFW.org, Terry DK, and all of our blog spots. Raucous Caucus is the whole point. Thank you for being raucous. Thank you for being
See you next week,
tonight.
7
Thank
o'clock, right here at Ben's Next
comments.
Door.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Tune in next Tuesday at 7 for another edition.